Ecologist and writer Alistair McIntosh describes himself as a pagan, Presbyterian, Quaker. Born in Doncaster but growing up on the Isle of Lewis with an English mother and Scottish father, he's a passionate advocate of non-violence. Alistair, pagan, Presbyterian, Quaker. What are you?
I'm glad you're laughing too, because of course, you know, that's the sort of thing you come out with tongue in cheek and then it catches. And I think one of the issues is that when, you know, when people sort of throw things at you, like, you know, my non-Christian friends will say I'm Presbyterian to the core, and my Christian friends will say I'm pagan to the core, then just embrace the whole lot and say, okay, I own up, I confess, I'm all of those things. And why not? Because there need be no fundamental contradiction between them.
Well, I want to sort of unpick that and go through these aspects one by one in the course of our chat. But can you just explain whether they are all aspects of what you believe, or whether there's one of these that is the central sort of core thing in your thinking?
Well, I would use the word pagan in its technical sense, meaning country dweller, one who is focused upon nature. But it's also something that a person like me, who's been very influenced, for example, by Hindu thought, that when, you know, some Christians will call me a pagan because of that, to say, well, yeah, why not? So, you know, pagan in the sense of nature religion, but also in terms of being open to other religions. Presbyterian, I grew up on the Isle of Lewis. Although I was born in England, that has very little impact upon my identity. I grew up in the Isle of Lewis of a father who was a doctor in a rural community, and it was a profoundly Presbyterian community with, you know, warts and all, but also all the wonderful side of what that bottom-up grassroots form of spirituality is, and that also finding expression in Quakerism, which is a perspective on spirituality that is rooted in the Christian tradition but is open to the wide world beyond that, fundamentally guided by a sense of the spirit of life, the Holy Spirit, if you like.
So it was the Presbyterianism really that came first for you as a child. That's what the kind of structure of your early years was.
Well, growing up in a Church of Scotland background, in a community that was largely free church and free Presbyterian, obviously you're immersed in Presbyterian thought. And at its best, Presbyterian thought is about spirituality from the grassroots upwards, the priesthood of all believers, if you like. And at its best, it's expressed in a very profound solidarity of community. And I think it's that understanding of community, of love made manifest amongst the whole people, that has perhaps most influenced my work from that upbringing. But equally, everything has its shadow side. And not in primary school, but in secondary school in Stornoway, you have teachers who belt the kids for not learning whole chunks of the Book of Daniel, I remember in one instance, off by heart. I think then you have to talk in terms of the spiritual abuse of children. And that when any form of religion is pushed down the throat of children, supposedly for their own good, and it's done with the sanction in those days of corporal punishment, then you're onto a pretty dodgy ground.
What effect did that have on you? Were you able to retain the core belief in that and reject what you felt was the abuse? Or did you at that time junk the whole lot?
No, at that time I largely junked the whole lot. I became agnostic, although very influenced by our minister at Martin's Memorial Church in Stornoway, the late Reverend Colin McLean, who was a wonderful man for getting us to be free thinkers and not imposing doctrine on us. And basically I decided by the time I went to university in Aberdeen in 1973 that I was agnostic, that I did not know whether or not there was such a thing as spiritual reality, such a thing as God. And part of that was my outrage at the spiritual hypocrisy of preaching a religion of love and yet forcing it on children. You know, in the Westminster Shorter Catechism of 1647, I think it was, that we all had drummed into us, humankind's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy God forever. And all the emphasis was placed on the glorification and none of it on the enjoyment from what I could see.
Have you retained a belief in Christ as divine, as God incarnate, or is your understanding of what was going on in the Gospels different?
I wouldn't say retained it. I would say more rediscovered it as I've gone through my journey, but rediscovered it in a non-exclusive sense. I do not consider Christ to be divine in a sense that was unique once and only. I consider Christ in the way that Christ himself defended himself against the Pharisees in John 10:34, a passage about which not many sermons are preached, where basically they're going to stone him for blasphemy, for claiming to be Son of God, and his defence is, read the Psalms, we are all sons and daughters of God. Now, I think that that understanding opens out the possibility that the spiritual principle that is Christ, the principle of love made incarnate in this world, can be understood like a crystal through many different facets. And I perfectly accept that for a Hindu, that same understanding might be seen through the lens of Krishna. For Muslims, it might be seen in the mystical ways that the Sufi tradition teaches. And for those of us who happen to be from Christian cultures, I'm very happy in my heart to embrace that through the lens of Christ. But I don't see that as being the only way in which it can be looked upon. I think we've got to be open to the idea that revelation comes in many different forms. Though the form in which Jesus represented it, I find a particularly compelling form.
So in a sense, you're saying anything goes?
I'm saying anything goes if it rests on that which gives life as love made manifest.
Now, to what extent were these ideas of spirituality born on Lewis, where you had your formative childhood experiences of everything very close to the sea and the earth?
I think it was the fact that we had real community, that we all looked out for one another, we all helped one another. But it's more than just a kind of sociological manner of relating together. I think we're also talking here about an understanding of what it means to be a human being that takes us beyond the idea that we're just brains carrying egos walking about in a physical body. That takes us into an idea where, in a very profound way, that community rests on being members one of another, that we are interconnected. And I would say that spirituality is, in its essence, the living reality that fundamentally we human beings, and indeed everything in this world, is animated by the same source of life. We're part of that divine process.
You were, of course, although you make it sound very idyllic, you were an outsider coming into this community, and especially when you got into secondary school in Stornoway, you were bullied for having an English accent and being that little bit different.
Well, that's right, because my mother was English, and up until the age of four, I'd grown up where my father had gone to work in a mining town, Doncaster, in England. So I was quite rightly seen as being an outsider, an incomer, somebody who was different. And I got, not in primary school in Lowerbust, but when I moved to secondary school in Stornoway, I did get quite heavily bullied because of that.
But you stuck up for yourself.
I did. I became quite a good fighter. I do remember the last three fights that I had and won. And I can remember, for example, sitting in the school music class and being kicked by this bully from behind whenever the teacher wasn't looking. And I just waited until the teacher went out of the room or something, and I turned round and I grabbed him by the collar with one hand, and I just laid into him incessantly with the fist of the other hand. And I can still remember the intense satisfaction of that experience. And yet the very satisfaction of that experience is precisely the danger in it that perpetrates cultures of violence.
And this is fascinating because you did go on to embrace nonviolence. And what we've got at this stage in your life, you're going off to Aberdeen University next, a young man who has really embraced agnosticism, abandoned the Presbyterian vision of Christianity, is keen on fighting if he has to, has a sort of spiritual connection with the land but hasn't articulated it to himself at that point. Is that right? And then you come to university,
right.
And what happens?
And then what happens? Well, basically your mind gets blown in many different ways. And for me, a number of things happened which caused the question of whether or not there is such a thing as a spiritual reality to become a very pressing question. I'm talking about when I was 18 or 19. And I embarked upon a search for evidence. I mean, I had a scientific upbringing. My father was a doctor, as well as being an elder of the church. I had a great respect for science and scientific method. So I started making a study of all kinds of weird happenings that were suggestive that there was more to this life than ordinary physics and chemistry might lead us to suggest.
Now, what sort of happenings were you looking at then?
Well, at a personal level, the most convincing one was one day I was back home from university, working at my desk, and I could see my father's beloved dog on the other side of the road, this dog, Sheba, a whippet. And she got up out of the ditch and ran across the road, slam into a passing vehicle, a passing van. And I ran out of the house and ran over, and the dog was stone dead on the road. And I said to the man, look, I saw it happen. There was nothing you could have done. I'll just take her and bury her. My mother had left 10 minutes earlier to go into Stornoway. My father was ill in hospital in Inverness, and she was off to see him. And it was like I was kind of distressed in myself, wondering how I was going to get this tragic news through to him. And I just got the hole adequately dug when, to my astonishment, my mother's car reappeared at high speed over the crest of the hill. So I ran towards her, and she got out of the car and ran towards me, looking like a ghost. And she shouted at me, "What's the matter?" And I said, "The dog's dead." She replied, "Thank goodness, I thought it might have been a child." And she'd just been on the outskirts of Stornoway, 7 miles away, when she had an overwhelming compulsion to turn back, because she knew something was wrong at home. Well, she was able to get back in the car and make it to Stornoway Airport in time for the flight to Inverness. And when she got to my father that afternoon, she said, "Ian, I've got bad news for you." And he said, "Yes, I know, it's Sheba, isn't it?" She said, "How did you know?" And he said, "Last night I got woken up several times by Sheba pawing my bed." Now, you see, when that kind of thing happens to you, it forces you to think that there is a way in which we are connected to one another beyond the bounds of normal space and time. And to me, that kind of thing, it doesn't embark you on a spiritual life, but it certainly blows away some of the intellectual cobwebs that you might otherwise use as an excuse from embarking on a spiritual life.
And was the result of your investigation of these kind of psychic happenings, for want of a better word, to make you conclude that these are phenomena that are open to everybody if only we opened our minds and our sort of antennae to them, or what?
I mean, what did you conclude? Absolutely. You know, I guarantee when I tell that story in a group, on average, at least one in four people will on the spot be able to counter it with a similar story that they've experienced. And studies by the Alistair Hardy Unit for Research into Religious Experience suggests that something like a quarter or a third of us have had such experiences that we will talk about to interviewers. In-depth studies suggest that even more people have had them and they just won't tell people unless they're feeling really safe to tell them. And the evidence would suggest that perhaps most of us have such an experience in the fullness of our life. So the point here is that religious experience is not something that just comes from creeds and dogmas, but it is something that has a scientific grounding. It has an empirical basis in actual experience that people have.
And how far does this take you down the line of ghosts and poltergeists and happenings of that sort?
Not very far down that line at all. You have explored down that line and found it to be a bit of a dead end. I think that with these type of stories, like I've just told you, we have to be very careful what claims we make about them at a rational level. And I'm prepared to make the claim on the kind of basis of the kind of evidence that I've shared with you, that there is grounds to believe that we are profoundly interconnected as human beings. How much further you go beyond that, whether, for example, we actually have things like astral bodies and so on, I think my personal jury remains out on, and I wouldn't want to make any definitive statement on that. But I'm certainly wanting to say that intellectually, I do not believe it is credible to deny the interconnection between people, given the kind of phenomena that I have seen with my own experience.
So you would be aligning yourself with Hamlet when he says there are more things in heaven and earth.
That puts it perfectly. That puts it perfectly. And then what's interesting are the ethical implications of that. Because if we are profoundly interconnected, if our psyches merge at some profound point that you might call God consciousness, then that poses profound questions as regards how we should relate to one another and therefore to the question of violence.
Now, your growing interest in non-violence, tell me about that, because it was focused, wasn't it, on the Iona community? What was the influence of that place on you?
Well, I worked for 5 years as business advisor to the Iona community. I remember one occasion before I went to work for the community, I'd gone up to Iona for one of the Peace and Justice Weeks that Helen Stephen used to run. And I think it was Tuesday evening in the Abbey, they would have a healing service with all the laying on of hands and so on, about which I was rather dubious. So I thought to myself, well, I'll go along to this, but I'll sit in the back where I can make a quick exit. And so there I was, and just as the service was beginning, two big men came in, one of them black American evidently, and the other one white, and they sat down just across from me at the back. And as the first hymn was starting, the white guy started singing very loud and erratically. And the hymn finished and there was a prayer, and then in the middle of it he shouts out, "You're all a crowd of effing hypocrites." Of stony silence. "If Jesus Christ could see the effing lot of you now, he'd be effing ashamed of you." And meanwhile, the black guy who's with the white guy squirming in his seat and obviously terribly embarrassed and starts trying to usher this madman out of the place and shuffling out the back. And I'm thinking to myself, well, hang on a minute, you know, if this really is a healing service, then maybe this is somebody who's mentally disturbed and he's come along specifically for that. You know, maybe he should be in here. So I went out and I went over to the guy and I said to him, you know, it is a healing service. If you want to come back, I'm sure it'd be all right. And he says to me, "Who the F do you think you are?" And then he starts challenging me to fight him. He starts threatening to bury me 6 feet under the peat because I've dared to come out and speak to him like this. And then he swings one at me and it just scrapes past the edge of my nose, trying to draw me into a fight.
Were you back in the playground for a moment there?
Back in the playground for a moment. And, you know, I had to make the decision, am I going to respond like with like and defend myself in the normal sort of way? Or is this going to be one of those several situations that I've had in life where you really have to put the non-violence into action and you have to sort of say, no matter what you do to me, I am not going to feed the violence. And I said to him, "You can hit me if you want, but I'm not going to hit you back." And he carried on shadow boxing me and trying to draw me into this. And what was amazing, what happened to me was that it was a bright, starry night outside Iona Abbey. And I had this profound experience where it felt as if a great hand swooped down from the cosmos and cupped me up in it and held me. And I had a profound conviction that no matter what happened, all will be well and all manner of thing shall be well. Now, by this time, the Abbey service had finished, and Helen Stephen, who was then the justice and peace worker, came out to see what had been going on. And she took over and led this guy back into the Abbey, and she sat up late that night with him. The next day she came to me and said, "Alistair, that man, he told me this morning that he had never before experienced such love." By the way, I'm not suggesting that's from what I did with him. I think it was more what she did with him. He'd never experienced such love, and he's now going to join the church. And she said, "And do you know who he was?" And I can tell this because he's now passed away. She said, "It was the great psychotherapist, R.D. Lang, Ronnie Lang."
It's astonishing.
And, you know, I've since read Clayton's wonderful biography of Lang, and at that time he was suffering heavily from alcoholism, and he was regularly challenging people to fights and having fights with them.
Can I ask you this, though? Clearly that's a marvellous story, and something very important was happening there. But are you saying that non-violence is an absolute? I mean, if there were a child being tortured in front of your eyes, would you still feel that you could not resort to violence to stop it?
I would feel that I couldn't resort to violence. I quite likely would resort to violence because I think your instincts kick in. I know your instincts kick in that kind of situation. But the point is, you need not prepare for a violent response. By choosing not to prepare for violence, you're forced into situations like the one I've just described with Ronnie Lang, where other forms of creativity can take over that, in my experience, often defuse the situation.
But you would admit that the human instincts to defend, maybe not even to defend oneself, but to defend another, can override the principle of non-violence. And I mean, how does it extend, for instance, to a country being invaded, instance?
Exactly. But you see, the instinct to defend with violence is usually in the very short term. You know, there is a 45-minute warning to being attacked by weapons of mass destruction. It's a panic reaction to that kind of stuff that throws us into hitting back. I think that when we have the wisdom to stand back and say, hang on, we actually have to plan our lives around taking away the causes that lead to violence, then we can start to tackle it at a root and branch level.
But I mean, I'm sure you've been asked this before then. Would you have not fought back in the Second World War then?
In the Second World War, coming from where I'm coming at now, no, I wouldn't have fought back. And what I would do is what I currently do with my life, namely consecrate it to trying to take away the causes that lead to violence, tackling violence at many different structural levels.
I accept while you're doing that, Hitler's getting on with taking over the world. That's the problem, isn't it?
But Hitler is, as Hitler knew well, he's dependent upon structures in his society that give rise to his support. So, you know, I'm never of the view that if you killed Al Capone, you'd have no more robberies. If you kill Hitler or Saddam, you'll have no more violence. You have violence in these men because they are capitalizing on social structures embedded within the people as a whole that allows them to be tyrants.
Did your Quakerism then grow out of the commitment to non-violence, or was it the other way around?
No, I got attracted to Quakerism at the time of Greenham Common and all of that resurgence in awareness of the nuclear threat that took place in the early 80s. And what simply happened is that I noticed that many of the most persuasive speakers on non-violence were people who happened to be Quakers. So I started investigating that and found an approach to the Christian tradition which fitted very comfortably with my pagan Presbyterianism.
And for those of us who aren't well up on what it is to be a Quaker, what is the core of your belief there?
Quakerism is based upon not having any clergy. There are no doctrines, no creeds, no sacraments in an outward sense, but focused around worship in silence, with people speaking only if they feel powerfully moved. And furthermore, basing your life and basing collective decisions on the principle of spiritual discernment, on the principle of trying to look inward to the core and trying to see what is the spiritual opening of the way. So Quakerism is not based on doctrines and creeds. It is based on opening ourselves, opening the human heart to the movement of the deep spirit of life.
So, Alistair McIntosh, pagan Presbyterian Quaker. What is the essence of what you would tell society it needs and is lacking?
I think what's wrong with us is that the secular mindset that most of our mainstream moves in cuts us off from what it is to be a human being. And, you know, what I'd love to say to people is, no matter what your spiritual tradition, if it is about life grounded in love, then wake up to that and celebrate it and recognize how it connects in with all other such philosophies of life as love made manifest.
Alistair McIntosh, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.